immediately in army parlance meant, of course, after an indefinite delay, so it was nearly 3 weeks before my orders came through to report back to Camp Barkley. I left early one October morning with three other MD students who, like me, had failed to stay in the program. One of the fellows had a car, an old black Plymouth, and we had arranged to drive out together. We were a pretty silent group driving west through the glorious autumn colors. I kept thinking about Dad, somewhere in France. The great D-Day invasion had taken place 4 months before, and Dad's unit had followed the first forces from the beachheads deep into France. It was during this advance that Dad's great contribution to the war had come. As they retreated, the Germans had had to abandon one of the great natural resources of Europe, the peat bogs of France and Belgium, vast natural reservoirs of fuel. To prevent this wealth from falling into Allied hands, the retreating Germans systematically flooded the low-lying bogs, rendering them, most people believed, unassailable for many years. The problem was handed to Dad. Within 6 weeks he had the peat works operational. Dad was a hero, his name mentioned in news stories and official reports. And his son? Heading out to boot camp, exactly where he was 13 months before. The only bright spot on my horizon that sparkling October day was a letter that had come from France the week before, hinting that Dad might be home by Christmas. Home. The family together. Except by Christmas, where would I be? Reassignment to Camp Barkley, effective immediately. Reclassification for active duty overseas, also effective as of this date. Then he added a personal note, Richie, if you get back from this war alive, I personally am going to see to it that you never get admitted into this medical school or any other. You've wasted the time of professors and staff, and you've kept out of the program a student who could have benefited from such an opportunity. I'm going to see that you never again squander the time and resources of the medical profession. I do not remember how I got out into the hallway. I only remember watching busy people passing briskly in front of me, people with places they had to be, and realizing that whether I walked to the right or to the left, up the stairs or down, it would not make the slightest difference to anyone on earth. It was the bleakest day of my life. It was also my 21st birthday. On the day when life was supposed to begin, mine had lost its purpose. What was left but to go back to drilling in the Texas dust, and eventually to walk into a bullet somewhere in Europe or Asia? Why, Jesus? I kept asking. Why couldn't I have stayed with you in the first place? The worst of it was, Mother was planning a big surprise party for me that night. Marguerite, who was working then in Richmond, was coming. My sister Mary Jane, her husband was in the Pacific, would be there, and Marguerite's older sister and her husband, and lots of others. And there would be gifts and congratulations and cards full of good wishes for the future. I walked slowly to my locker, and took as long as I could about emptying it. Medical texts, notebooks full of ink-stained pages, my bag of bones. How could I ask Marguerite to marry me now, when I would have no way to support her after the war, even supposing I got back? How easy it would be. The thought came, to go up to the chemistry lab and mix a few ingredients in a beaker. I might be too stupid to be a doctor, but I had understood the lectures on poisons well enough, and I would not be the first exam student to take this way out. The picture was in my mind for only an instant, crowded out by another one. The suicides I had seen chained for how long in a realm where a minute could last an eternity, to the very situations they had tried to escape. If I could not face Marguerite's disappointment in me that night, how could I bear it for a timeless forever? I saw those tortured eyes, heard their I'm sorry, endlessly repeated, never reaching the ears it was meant for, and I knew they would stand forever between me and any serious impulse to take my own life. I went to my birthday party. I blew out the candles on my cake, unwrapped ribbon and tissue paper, and laughed at the jokes about how much money doctors made. Then when the others were gone I told Mother and Marguerite. They were wonderful about it, reminding me that a quarter of the class was always eliminated by that time. If not me, Marguerite pointed out, someone else would be feeling disappointment. Which only made me feel worse about the girl I was saying goodbye to. Immediately in army parlance meant, of course, after an indefinite delay, so it was nearly 3 weeks before my orders came through to report back to Camp Barkley. I left early one October morning with three other students who, like me, had failed to stay in the program. One of the fellows had a car, an old black Plymouth, and we had arranged to drive out together. We were a pretty silent group driving west through the glorious autumn colors. I kept thinking about Dad, somewhere in France. The great D-Day invasion had taken place 4 months before, and Dad's unit had followed the first forces from the beachheads deep into France. It was during this advance that Dad's great contribution to the war had come. As they retreated, the Germans had had to abandon one of the great natural resources of Europe, the peat bogs of France and Belgium, vast natural reservoirs of fuel. To prevent this wealth from falling into Allied hands, the retreating Germans systematically flooded the low-lying bogs, rendering them, most people believed, unusable for many years. The problem was handed to Dad. Within 6 weeks he had the peat works operational. Dad was a hero, his name mentioned in news stories and official reports. And his son? Heading out to boot camp, exactly where he was 13 months before. The only bright spot on my horizon that sparkling October day was a letter that had come from France the week before, hinting that Dad might be home by Christmas. Home. The family together. Except by Christmas, where would I be? We got as far as Cincinnati that first night, not talking much, each of us probably wrestling with thoughts about like mine. By the next day we relaxed a little, taking turns at the wheel, talking about our girlfriends, the World Series, the fishing we had done or had not done over the summer, everything except school and the war. Louisville, Memphis. The afternoon of the third day we reached the Mississippi and drove south along the east bank, heading for the river crossing at Vicksburg. On both sides of the river stretched empty corn and sugar fields, miles and miles of brown stubble in the fall sunshine, ahead of us Vicksburg, Mississippi, on its high plateau. Pete was at the wheel, the rest of us watching for signs to the bridge that showed on our map. In the city Pete took a street leading down toward the river. See any signs? He asked me over his shoulder. From my position in the back seat I was supposed to keep an eye out the left-hand window. I did not answer. For the last mile my mouth had been feeling dry, my stomach tight. Something about the layout of this town seemed strangely, impossibly familiar. I knew I had never been there before, and yet I knew exactly how the shoreline would look around the next curve. How the streets would intersect. There. Just as I had known they would. And all at once I knew for sure that straight ahead on that very street we would come in a few blocks to a white frame building with a red roof and the word cafe in neon letters over the door. There it is. To the left. The guy in the front next to Pete pointed to a small sign at the corner. The bridge must be back up that way. Pete slowed the car and put out his hand to signal a left-hand turn. Please. My voice was harsh. Don't stop, Pete. Keep going straight. The guy who had seen the sign turned around to stare at me. The sign points up that way. I know. I'd just like to drive another couple of blocks in this direction, that's all. Everyone in the car was looking at me now. I thought I recognized something, I said. Pete shrugged and straightened the wheel. How much farther? He said, driving slowly ahead. My heart was hammering too hard to speak. A block ahead, on my side of the car, on the corner, was a white all-night cafe with a red roof. The neon letters over the door were turned off in the bright daylight, but the Pabst sign was still propped in the right-hand window. There was the sidewalk where I walked beside a man who could not see me. There was the telephone pole where I had stood so long, how long? In what kind of time and what kind of body? Stop. I cried. For Pete was passing the little restaurant. Pete pulled over to the curb and again I was aware of the stares of the others. It was a perfectly ordinary street, like a dozen others we had driven down since leaving Richmond. I thought you'd never been in Mississippi? Pete said. My hand was sweaty on the door handle. I longed to leap out of that car, to run across the street to that phone pole, to grab that guy wire, grab it and shake it. To open the door to that cafe and walk in and watch whoever was in the lookup. To ask a question, what time is it? Anything, just to hear my own voice and hear them answer. I let go of the handle and forced my eyes away from the white cafe on the corner. I didn't think I had, either, I said. What else could I say? I was here one night when I was also lying in a hospital bed in Texas. Pete twisted the wheel impatiently and followed the signs back up the sloping streets to the bridge. But on the map on my lap, my finger traced a line, Abilene, Texas, across Arkansas, across Louisiana, a straight line due east from Abilene to Vicksburg, Mississippi. As we drove across the broad, brown expanse of water, a voice inside me was shouting. So it was here. Vicksburg, Mississippi. Here was where I stopped in that headlong bodiless flight. Here I stopped, and thought, and turned back. We got as far as Cincinnati that first night, not talking much, each of us probably wrestling with thoughts about like mine. By the next day we relaxed a little, taking turns at the wheel, talking about our girlfriends, the World Series, the fishing we had done or had not done over the summer, everything except school and the war. Louisville, Memphis. The afternoon of the third day we reached the Mississippi and drove south along the east bank, heading for the river crossing at Vicksburg. On both sides of the river stretched empty corn and sugar fields, miles and miles of brown stubble in the fall sunshine, ahead of us Vicksburg, Mississippi, on its high plateau. Pete was at the wheel, the rest of us watching for signs to the bridge that showed on our map. In the city Pete took a street leading down toward the river. See any signs? He asked me over his shoulder. From my position in the back seat I was supposed to keep an eye out the left-hand window. I did not answer. For the last mile my mouth had been feeling dry, my stomach tight. Something about the layout of this town seemed strangely, impossibly familiar. I knew I had never been there before, and yet I knew exactly how the shoreline would look around the next curve. How the streets would intersect. There. Just as I had known they would. And all at once I knew for sure that straight ahead on that very street we would come in a few blocks to a white frame building with a red roof and the word cafe in neon letters over the door. There it is. To the left. The guy in the front next to Pete pointed to a small sign at the corner. The bridge must be back up that way. Pete slowed the car and put out his hand to signal a left-hand turn. Please. My voice was harsh. Don't stop, Pete. Keep going straight. The guy who had seen the sign turned around to stare at me. The sign points up that way. I know. I'd just like to drive another couple of blocks in this direction, that's all. Everyone in the car was looking at me now. I thought I recognized something, I said. Pete shrugged and straightened the wheel. How much farther? He said, driving slowly ahead. My heart was hammering too hard to speak. A block ahead, on my side of the car, on the corner, was a white all-night cafe with a red roof. The neon letters over the door were turned off in there. Bright daylight, but the Pabst sign was still propped in the right-hand window. There was the sidewalk where I walked beside a man who could not see me. There was the telephone pole where I had stood so long, how long? In what kind of time and what kind of body? Stop. I cried. For Pete was passing the little restaurant. Pete pulled over to the curb and again I was aware of the stares of the others. It was a perfectly ordinary street, like a dozen others we had driven down since leaving Richmond. I thought you'd never been in Mississippi? Pete said. My hand was sweaty on the door handle. I longed to leap out of that car, to run across the street to that phone pole, to grab that guy wire, grab it and shake it. To open the door to that cafe and walk in and watch whoever was in the lookup. To ask a question. What time is it? Anything, just to hear my own voice and hear them answer. I let go of the handle and forced my eyes away from the white cafe on the corner. I didn't think I had, either, I said. What else could I say? I was here one night when I was also lying in a hospital bed in Texas. Pete twisted the wheel impatiently and followed the signs back up the sloping streets to the bridge. But on the map on my lap, my finger traced a line, Abilene, Texas, across Arkansas, across Louisiana, a straight line due east from Abilene to Vicksburg, Mississippi. As we drove across the broad, brown expanse of water, a voice inside me was shouting. So it was here. Vicksburg, Mississippi. Here was where I stopped in that headlong bodiless flight. Here I stopped, and thought, and turned back. 12 I stayed only 2 weeks, this time, at Camp Barkley. The soldiers I had trained with were gone, of course, shipped to battlefronts all over the world, and other trainloads of recruits had come and gone since then. Because of my partial medical training, I was assigned to the Medical Administrative Corps and put in a holding company waiting assignment to a field hospital. Meanwhile, the routine at Camp Barkley was the same as for everyone else: marching, 10 hours a day, in the eye-stinging, throat-clogging dust. On my first time off, I hitched a ride over to the hospital and looked up Lieutenant Irvine. Bad break, she said when I told her about my poor performance in school. You weren't really back to normal, you know, when you left here. You'll do better next time, after the war. She seemed so full of confidence in me that I did not tell her what the school official had said. I wished I could tell her, though, about driving through Vicksburg and seeing a cafe where I had stood while my physical body lay in that very hospital ward. But my disastrous attempts to describe the experience to Marguerite had taught me something. Talking about the events of that night had a strange power, a power God could use. But it must be at his timing, as it had been with Mother, in our living room, the night I returned to Richmond. It was not something I could simply take on myself to talk about for reasons of my own. Then, as I had with Marguerite, I would make a total mess of it. In early November I was sent to Camp Rucker, Alabama, for training as a medical and surgical technician with the 123rd Evacuation Hospital. The Battle of the Bulge was underway in Europe, and units like the 123rd were being assembled and shipped to the front as rapidly as personnel could be found. I got only one weekend pass, just before Thanksgiving, for a swift trip from Alabama to Virginia and a brief visit with Marguerite and my family. Mother still expected Dad home by Christmas, and now all my hopes centered on seeing him before I myself sailed for France. The 123rd boarded the train at Camp Rucker on Christmas Eve, 1944, bound for Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, and embarkation. That night, trying to sleep in the upright seat, my thoughts kept going back to the previous Christmas Eve when I awoke in a hospital bed with a pain in my chest and a memory of the most loving presence I had ever known. Where had he been in the year since then, this Jesus I had met? He could not have changed or gone away. That light was too all-penetrating for me to imagine any time or place that he did not fill. But that, now, was simply head knowledge. Why wasn't he making more difference in the way I handled things? You would expect, I told myself, that anyone who had had an experience like mine, anyone who had glimpsed even dimly the love behind the universe, would no longer get upset by external things that happened. But I was. Terribly. I was riled by the blustering sergeant sitting 3 seats ahead of me now, the smell of his black cheroot filling the coach. I was bothered when the men in the 123rd, mostly northerners from big cities, made fun of my southern accent and small-town ideas. Instead of being able, now, to shrug such things off, I found them bothering me more than they ever had. Toward morning the train stood for a long time on a dark stretch of tracks somewhere. There was a road nearby. Occasionally I saw car headlights crossing an overpass up ahead. Then a wintry dawn broke and a great lump came into my throat. We were at the Acre Switchyards just outside Richmond, Virginia, less than 1 mile from my home. There was the engine house of the old Richmond, Fredericksburg, and Potomac Railroad, where Papa Dabney used to bring me down to watch the trains. And that bridge. I must have pedaled my bicycle 1,000 times over that road between my folks' place and Moss Side. It was Christmas morning and my family was just 1 mile on the other side of those trees. The homesickness I had been fighting down rose up in a flood. I wondered if Henry and Bruce Gordon were awake yet. They were always the first ones up on Christmas morning. Had Dad gotten home yesterday? After being separated by thousands of miles and a world war, were we within a mile of each other at this moment? About 7 a.m. there was a jerk and a grinding of wheels and the train began to move again. Speeding up, slowing, stopping, it took all day to reach Camp Kilmer, the longest Christmas of my life. From a phone booth, somewhere in the camp, I talked to my family. Dad had been home, he had reached Richmond on Christmas Eve. Our sailing date was not known, of course, but they were issuing 12-hour passes for the 28th. That was not time enough to get down to Richmond, but I could make it as far as Washington and back. And so the family took a train from Richmond up to Washington, and I took one down from New Jersey. I saw them standing on the platform at Washington's Union Station before my coach even came to a stop, though it was a moment before I recognized the gray-haired man standing next to Mother. When he left for Europe, Dad's hair had been jet black. His hair and the lines in his face spoke of what he had been through. He himself talked only of cheerful things, how good his family looked, how much I was going to enjoy the beautiful countryside of France. We had half an hour, sitting on the bench in the crowded waiting room. Then my return train was called and I waved from the window until I lost them in the crowd of other wartime farewells. 13 The 123rd Evac Hospital boarded the SS Brazil on New Year's Day, 1945, while the Red Cross dispensed donuts on the pier and a band played My Mama Done Told Me. 3 days out, the convoy was struck by a savage North Atlantic storm. The 123rd was berthed on the highest deck on the ship, just below the captain's bridge, but high as we were, for 2 days waves smacked against the deckhouses and seeped under doorways. Under these conditions, hard-boiled eggs seemed to be the only food the galleys could send up, but most of us were too seasick to eat anyway. In spite of the storm, there were apparently submarines in the area. For tension-racked hours we sat on our crazily rocking bunks, stacked four high, one above the other, listening to the depth charges drop from the lower decks and explode in the water far beneath us. Looking at the strained faces around me, I realized two things about my own feelings. About the prospect of being torpedoed and having to take to lifeboats in that icy gale, I was as terrified as the next guy. The mechanics of dying, the pain and panic, were as frightening to me as they had ever been. But as for death itself, I not only felt no fear of it, I found myself wishing it would happen. Then I would be with him. I would be out of this miserable world where men crossed an ocean to kill other men and where even among ourselves there was so little love. At 4 a.m. on January 16th, the SS Brazil anchored in a thick fog outside the French port of Le Havre. As it grew light, we crowded the railings to catch our first look at Europe. Slowly the grey mist lifted. Twisted steel hulks that had once been ships, a single wall where a block of buildings had stood. No newsreel had prepared me for my first view of a bombed-out city. The harbor was too choked with wreckage for our ship to get closer, and we were brought ashore in small landing craft, then marched to a row of open trucks for transport to Camp Lucky Strike, a staging point some 60 miles inland. The 2-inch snowfall in the back of the trucks swiftly turned to ice as we trampled it with our boots. Most of the soldiers crouched down by the sides of the truck to get out of the piercing wind, but I stood transfixed as we lumbered through the city, past gutted homes where shreds of bright wallpaper fluttered in the wind. I kept thinking of Dad with his lined face and grey hair, understanding better what the invasion had been like. At Lucky Strike we put up our tents and then sat on our cots, trying to rub some feeling back into our feet. We were standing in the chow line the next morning when a jeep tore into the camp, the driver shouting something about a train wreck. We piled into every available vehicle and on the way got fragments of the story. It was American troops from our own SS Brazil who were aboard the train, sabotage by Vichy French forces was suspected. Apparently our unit, on the highest deck, had been the first to be debarked from the ship and the only one to be sent on to Camp Lucky Strike by road. The entire rest of the ship, several thousand troops, had been loaded throughout the day and the evening onto a train of 48s, small French baggage cars built to carry either 40 men or 8 horses. It was after midnight before they were all aboard and the slow trip over the disrupted French rail system began. Approaching the nearby station of Street Valerie en Caux, the train was mysteriously switched to a little used sidetrack terminating at the station house. Traveling full speed, the train crashed into the brick wall of the building. I had never seen nor imagined such a scene of carnage. Some of the men had been killed outright, many more were pinned inside the wreckage, crying out for help. We stepped over severed arms and legs, we wrestled with tangled metal keeping us from reaching our shipmates. I found myself assigned to a captain working in an improvised first aid tent. But our medical supplies were not yet unloaded from the ship. For a long time between the doctor and me we had one pair of nurses' bandage scissors, a needle and thread, and a few emergency shots of morphine. It was my first exposure to human suffering on a large scale. I had once thought I wanted to help people in pain, but I had been thinking of natural problems like Papa Dabney and his arthritis. What was facing us today was suffering deliberately inflicted by one group of people on another. If hatred could grow this powerful, for we were preparing to do the same thing to them, who wanted to live in such a world. At the end of the nightmare day, when the last casualty had been sent by ambulance to the nearest hospital, I found myself brooding on the fact that others had been permitted to leave this existence while I was condemned to stay. I had seen fellows my age die that day, and except for their suffering, felt a pang of envy for them. Why had our unit been the only one that was not aboard the train? 13, the 123rd Evac Hospital boarded the SS Brazil on New Year's Day, 1945, while the Red Cross dispensed donuts on the pier and a band played My Mama Done Told Me. 3 days out, the convoy was struck by a savage North Atlantic storm. The 123rd was berthed on the highest deck on the ship, just below the captain's bridge. But high as we were, for 2 days waves smacked against the deckhouses and seeped under doorways. Under these conditions hard-boiled eggs seemed to be the only food the galleys could send up, but most of us were too seasick to eat anyway. In spite of the storm there were apparently submarines in the area. For tension-racked hours we sat on our crazily rocking bunks, stacked 4 high. One above the other, listening to the depth charges drop from the lower decks and explode in the water far beneath us. Looking at the strained faces around me, I realized 2 things about my own feelings. About the prospect of being torpedoed and having to take to lifeboats in that icy gale, I was as terrified as the next guy. The mechanics of dying, the pain and panic, were as frightening to me as they had ever been. But as for death itself, I not only felt no fear of it, I found myself wishing it would happen. Then I would be with him. I would be out of this miserable world where men crossed an ocean to kill other men and where even among ourselves there was so little love. At 4 a.m. on January 16th the SS Brazil anchored in a thick fog outside the French port of Le Havre. As it grew light we crowded the railings to catch our first look at Europe. Slowly the grey mist lifted. Twisted steel hulks that had once been ships, a single wall where a block of buildings had stood, no newsreel had prepared me for my first view of a bombed-out city. The harbor was too choked with wreckage for our ship to get closer and we were brought ashore in small landing craft, then marched to a row of open trucks for transport to Camp Lucky Strike, a staging point some 60 miles inland. The 2-inch snowfall in the back of the trucks swiftly turned to ice as we trampled it with our boots. Most of the soldiers crouched down by the sides of the truck to get out of the piercing wind, but I stood transfixed as we lumbered through the city, past gutted homes where shreds of bright wallpaper fluttered in the wind. I kept thinking of Dad with his lined face and grey hair, understanding better what the invasion had been like. At Lucky Strike we put up our tents and then sat on our cots. trying to rub some feeling back into our feet. We were standing in the chow line the next morning when a jeep tore into the camp, the driver shouting something about a train wreck. We piled into every available vehicle and on the way got fragments of the story.